Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. As part of our ongoing 2012 election coverage, we present the third installment of this year's Candidate Conversation Series. We've designed these conversations to connect you with those who want your vote. And today we're speaking with the candidate seeking election in Virginia's 3rd Congressional District. That includes all of Portsmouth and portions of Norfolk, Richmond, Petersburg, Hampton, and Newport News, among others, all along the James River. So we'll have that conversation and take your calls after this news from NPR. Minutes past the hour, and it's great to be with you on a really beautiful Monday afternoon out there in Hampton Roads. And we're talking with the candidates today in the 3rd Congressional District. As you know, Election Day is coming up November 6th. Unless you have really been keeping yourself away from the news, I'm sure you're fully aware of that. But at any rate, there are two candidates in the 3rd Congressional District, and we'll be talking to them today in the course of this program. This is part of our continuing conversation. As you know, the way we do this is we essentially divide the hour among the number of candidates who make the ballot. And our rules are pretty simple. We ask you not to talk about the opponent. We ask you to talk about what you want to do and take questions and calls from our listeners, talk about why you think we are where we are and what you would do about it. And so that's where we are today. We're talking about the 3rd Congressional District, and this is important because the 3rd had changes to it, as did many congressional districts in the wake of the last census. So you really do want to take a trip over to the State Board of Education website where you can learn more. Board of Elections website, where you can learn more about where you live. And you put your address in there, it'll return to you the district in which you are currently assigned. 15% of the 3rd is now comprised of folks who used to be in the 1st, the 2nd, the 4th, and the 7th. So that's why it's really important for you to head on over there and make sure that you show up at the right polling place on Election Day. Really important. 7 minutes past the hour. We're glad to have the incumbent Congressman Bobby Scott in the first half of our hour today. And in the second half, we'll talk with his challenger, Dean Longo. Congressman Scott, good to see you today. Thank you for being back with us.
Good to see you, and thank you, Kathy. This is a great format because it gives people an opportunity to actually sit down and discuss the issues in some depth, not just a 30-second soundbite.
These are complex issues, and you cannot do them in 7-second soundbites, that's for sure.
And that's the problem. People try to reduce them to soundbites and slogans, and a lot of it just doesn't add up when you subject it to any scrutiny at all.
Well, as you know, and your district is certainly mightily affected by this, one of the big issues on the agenda right now with a year-end deadline staring us in the face is this issue of sequestration. That was the bargain that was struck last spring when there was the vote to raise the debt ceiling, and the deal was, all right, we'll raise the debt ceiling, but we're going to have to come up with very specific spending cuts by the end of the year, and if we don't do that, then there's this large package of across-the-board cuts that are put into place that will have a pretty dramatic effect on our economy if they go through.
Well, half of it is defense and half non-defense. I think this area is well aware of the effect of the defense cuts. Almost half of the Hampton Roads economy depends on the Department of Defense, and a substantial portion of the rest depends on other government spending. We have NASA Langley, which is not Department of Defense, all the Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid checks that come into the area, a substantial portion of the economy of the Hampton Roads area depends on federal spending, education grants, and everything else. And so an across-the-board cut obviously will have an adverse effect. But the thing that it points out is that you mentioned the bargain. It wasn't much of a bargain. The Republicans in the House threatened to credibly threatened to fail to increase the debt ceiling, which the fact that it was in fact a credible, you always talk about it, but this time the S&P thought it was in fact a credible threat and downgraded our credit rating as a result of the Republicans in the House. I mean, the senators were using the same rhetoric, are we going to do this when we raise the debt ceiling? But it was always in the context of of course we're going to raise the debt ceiling. It wasn't any threat not to do it. They were going to just use that process to for their gains, and that's part of the process. But the Republicans in the House really threatened. And so we ended up with this cross-the-board sequestration thing. The idea of across-the-board cuts was not new to the Republicans because they had the similar across-the-board cuts in their cap, cut, and balance scheme that they had voted for and passed through the House. So the idea that these across-the-board cuts are somehow strangers to the Republicans, it was their idea to begin with. And if you look at the press releases after it occurred, all the Speaker of the House was just giddy. I got 98% of what I wanted. Mm-hmm. All the Republicans were just bragging about what they did. And it will seriously adverse affect the Hampton Roads area.
So what do we do about that at this point? Because we have 6 weeks before the end of the year
to do
something.
The deal is you have to come up with $1 trillion in deficit reduction. And the fact that you have the people running around all over the country, we had 3 United States senators in Hampton Roads trying to explain to an area half of whose economy is defense, that massive cuts in defense aren't a good idea. I mean, we didn't need to hear that. You ask them, well, what the idea is, you got to have $1 trillion, approximately $1 trillion in deficit reduction. Well, what is their proposal? They did not have a proposal. In fact, they went back to D.C. that same week and voted to extend the Bush-era tax cuts $4 trillion. They can't find $1 trillion to offset the sequester, but they found $4 trillion to vote for to extend the
sequester. So what do you see happening before the end
of
the year?
Well, first of all, you have to get serious and you have to use arithmetic. The fact is you can't make a list of cuts anywhere close to $1 trillion that the people would go along with. And in the overall budget thing, everybody is pretty well agreed. And we're talking 10-year numbers. Everybody has agreed in 10 years we need to cut the deficit $4 trillion. $4 trillion. We can't even do the first trillion in cuts. So when you start talking about reduce the size of government with unspecified cuts and think you can get to $4 trillion, that is absurd. Mm. Because the first trillion, you got people running around the country with their hair on fire, can't even do that. And so
what would you favor?
The entire non-defense discretionary budget, if you take off the table Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and defense, you've only got about $400 billion left. $4 trillion over 10 years is $400 billion a year. You would have to eliminate government to get to four. The discussion is absurd because it does not conform to arithmetic. My view is you start off letting the Bush-era tax cuts expire. That will get you the $4 trillion, job done, go home. You've got your $4 trillion. You don't have to do anything else. In addition to that, you can do additional revenues. Treat investment income like regular income. In the 1950s, dividend income was substantially higher taxed than earned income. Now it's taxed at about half the rate. Go back to even Steven. That'll get you $1 trillion. You can tax, change the corporate tax structure where there's a preference for debt equity, where you sell bonds rather than sell stock. If you eliminate that preference to bonds, that would get you another $1 trillion because interest on bonds is deductible. Dividends is not a deductible expense. You got to pay taxes first. Pay tax before you pay off the bonds. That would get you another trillion. 5% surcharge on millionaires. And that portion of your income over $1 million. Add 5% to that, which is less than the rate for Social Security taxes. People are paying 6% now. They don't pay any of that. Let them pay about 5%, which is less than the working man is paying for his Social Security. And then add some the oil preference tax, the yacht taxes, the corporate jets. Just piece them together. You get another half trillion. That'll give you 7. You need 4. To get to deficit reduction. And I believe all of those would be preferable when you put the choice to the people, not just how would you like a tax cut or how would you like some more spending without having to worry about the arithmetic and the balance. You put that $7 trillion to people, I think they would accept any of that $7 trillion before they would want to cut Social Security, Medicare, Head Start, Meals on Wheels, Pell Grants, air traffic controllers, or whatever list they would have to put together to get anywhere close to $4 trillion.
We're at 14 minutes past the hour. If you have questions for Congressman Bobby Scott, the numbers are 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. He is running for that third district. district seat, 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240.
And the problem you got is that the Republicans have convinced the public that you can cut taxes, increase spending, and Santa Claus will balance the budget. And they actually believe it. And if you look at their legislation, when they passed, they're talking about repealing Obamacare, but keeping the good parts, not and letting the bad parts be repealed. Well, that's what they did with the prescriptive drug benefit. They passed the good parts. That's all the benefits. They did not pass the bad parts, paying for it.
So it went straight
to the deficit, and they believe that.
So your take is this deficit is a very serious problem, and that there are ways to get at it than what you mentioned about $7 trillion just right there.
You need four.
And you need four. So what do you think the prospects, I mean, we've had a lot of commissions that have come out and talked about this issue, and some of these ideas they've discussed.
Simpson-Bowles, extended most of the tax cuts and paid for it by cutting Medicare, Social Security, and across the board cuts in education and a lot of other things. I think.
So you're saying you don't have to do that. You can do these other things and
I would like to at least get to a choice. What are the choices? If the choice is, shall we have tax cuts for millionaires and we can pay for it with Social Security cuts and Medicare cuts, I think the people would say, well, let the millionaires wait. Don't cut Social Security and Medicare. And I think nobody ever presents these as a choice. They say, well, let's have a formula. Let's have a process. Can't we all get along? No, let's put some numbers on the page and come up with some choices.
Let's go to Jane on the line now from Norfolk. Hi, Jane, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I just want to say that they finally did one thing right in Richmond this year when they redistricted things. They let me keep Bobby Scott as my congressman, and
okay,
I am
Jane.
So pleased. 99% of his votes I agree with completely. I'm just delighted to have him, and thank you for letting me say this out loud to the whole darn city and area.
All right,
well,
Jane, thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'm going to try to protect. One of the things that we're running into is that in this campaign is some of these, and because we don't have forums like this where you can actually discuss issues, the Medicare issue has been discussed. The first thing out of their mouths is people over 55 are not affected. Wrong. That's absolutely false. If Governor Romney's plans go into effect, people over 55 will pay more. If you're 55 today, you'll pay about $18,000 more during your retirement. If you're 65 today, about $11,000 more. That's because when you look at all his proposals, people now on Medicare are getting free checkups and cancer screenings, no copay and deductibles. He's going to make them pay copays and deductible. He's going to reopen. We're closing the donut hole. He's going to reopen the donut hole, and he's going to have more. It's going to be a more expensive process, so that the copays, deductibles, and Part B premiums will go up.
What would you change about Medicare?
And his problems. And when he says he's preserving it after he cuts all the benefits. In the end, the program that is solvent for 12 years will go broke in 4 years. So he's not preserving anything. It's going broke quicker. And so when you just say these things and people get confused. Of course, if you're under 55, if you're 54 today, you can expect to spend about $60,000 more during your retirement. You're going to be paying about $500 a month for health care under Romney's plan than you're paying today. Every month, just go find $500.
So what do you think we need to do then about Medicare? Because I think a lot of people agree it can't continue the way it is. Do you think it can?
The Democrats cut $716 billion out of Medicare, if you didn't notice. I mean, if you watch some of the commercials, $716. We cut corporate subsidies. We cut overpayments. We had efficiencies. Did not affect one dime of benefits. Okay. And what is $700 billion over 10 years? That's about $70 billion a year, which is equivalent to about a 10 to 15% cut of everything non-defense discretionary budget. We did that. Okay. What's the Republican response? Put the money back, every dime. And that's why they don't increase revenues. They put every dime back. That's why it goes broke in 4 years rather than 12 years. I mean, people say, well, you got to cut. We did. And they won't go for it. Except Paul Ryan did first. He put it in his budget, but he used the money to pay for tax cuts for millionaires. My question is, when you say you got to cut Medicare, That's just half the equation. If you cut it, what are you going to do with it? If you leave the money and improve Medicare like we did, extended the solvency 8 years, then that's one thing. If you're going to use it to if you're going to make the cuts and use it to fund tax cuts for millionaires in the Ryan budget,
what about drug cost negotiation?
He found $716 billion that cut out of Medicare and used it. It's almost a dollar for dollar equivalent. Use it to fund tax cuts on that portion of your income over $250,000. That portion of your income over $250,000, you got a tax cut paid for courtesy of Medicare. There are things Democrats have tried from the beginning to...
Some of your colleagues have talked about negotiating drug prices.
To negotiate drug prices. You can get hundreds of billions of dollars out of that. There's a provision in the drug in the prescriptive drug bill that provided that you cannot negotiate drug prices. Now, Medicaid can, VA can, all corporations negotiate prices, but there's a provision if a drug company wants a certain price for a bill, even though they're selling it elsewhere for less and overseas for less, it is illegal for the Department of Health and Human Services to say, well, how about a little, why don't you charge us the same as you do in Canada? Why don't you charge the same everywhere? Illegal. And so that would I don't know how that provision got in the bill, but when you look at the Medicare choices, if you're going to cut Medicare and raise prices for those who are on Medicare today, giving everybody else that little puny inadequate voucher that's not going to keep up with inflation and cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, if you're in your 20s now, it's going to cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars more for health care than the present system, and so you have a choice. You can the question is on overall budget. The goal is $4 trillion. If you're going to get some of that out of cuts in Medicare, then that's a choice you've made rather than get it somewhere else. And the Medicare cuts go for the overall budget. My view is you can do if you let the tax cuts expire, you got your goal.
You can get $7 trillion without that.
You can get $7 trillion if you just let the Bush tax cuts expire. You get $4 trillion. That's all you need. You don't have to cut Social Security. You don't have to cut Medicare. You don't have to cut Pell Grants. You don't have to cut embassy security like the Republicans did. They cut. When you start talking about reducing the size of government, you got to start talking about numbers on line items. Reducing the size of government included cuts in embassy security. And then they're talking about complaining about the problem we had overseas.
But let's talk about the dollars and cents of transportation in the third before the time.
There's no money for
us.
There's no money for transportation if you extend the tax cuts, because you have to pay for it. You can't pay for if you extend $4 trillion in tax cuts. Where are you going to get the money? Well, you have shown what $1 trillion looks like. It looks like the sequester. Everybody's got their hair on fire. They're running around like they're crazy on the first trillion. How are you going to get to four if you're doing it all spending cuts? There's no
one transportation. One of the things we are told here in Hampton Roads is that because of the General Assembly's inability to fund transportation, that our construction budget will be broke by something on the order of 2017, something like that.
Well, transportation.
And that if for every dollar we have to put a dollar on the table for the four we get from the federal government.
Well, the transportation is arithmetic. If you're not, Santa Claus is not going to build a tunnel. You have to come up with some revenue to pay for it. And so, I mean, it's all arithmetic, and you need to be honest with people. And as we're running out of time, they're you know, I'm proud of my record. I've done a lot. I've passed more bills that have been signed into law than Paul Ryan has. But bills that signed into law aren't really a reflection. I've worked hard in criminal justice. Last week I got an award from the Justice Roundtable because of my criminal justice work. About a week before that, I got an award from the community health organization statewide for my work in community health. Tomorrow night, I'm going to get an award from Voices for Virginia's Children for my work in children. The number of bills that are signed into law is not the reflection of what you do. Like I said, Paul Ryan only had two bills signed into law. I've had more than that. But we need to work hard effectively across party lines. And you have to tell the truth. And you have to explain things like the Lilly Ledbetter Act. Everybody kind of knows generally that's fair pay for women. But they don't recognize that if that bill had not passed, Lily Ledbetter was discriminated against. When she went into court, they said, it's too late for you to file. She said, I just found out. The decision to start discriminating against her had been made years before. They'd been discriminating against her for years, and the court said, well, the decision was made years ago. It's too late for you to file now. The first bill that President Obama signed said, no, if you're being discriminated against and they give you a discriminatory paycheck, the clock starts over. It's not too late. Now, the alternative to that, if he hadn't signed that bill, there are people in America that you could have a group of women going into the employer and said, you're underpaying us. And the employer says, we always pay women less than men. We've been doing it for years. Those women would have no recourse until the Lilly Ledbetter Act was passed. And there's the first bill President Obama signed. Governor Romney doesn't know what he would have done.
I want to come back
to this. With women who have no recourse. What's that about?
I want to come back to this question on transportation as well, just because we only have a few minutes left. And this is the one that people are talking about in this community in terms of the tolls that are coming to the tunnel, in terms of bridges that are having a lot of problems. Has the delegation met with you? I mean, there's a concern that I hear when I go out that there doesn't seem to be that you can't do what you need to do until there's money in that construction budget.
Well, the as I indicated, Santa Claus is not going to build the tunnel. We need to come up with revenues. And if you say no to tolls and no to sales taxes and no to gas taxes and no to everything else, there won't be any money on the table with the present revenue. I'm kind of esoteric about how you do it, but you have to first recognize that you have to do it. You have to come up with some revenues. Gas tax is proportional to those who drive. That makes sense. Modest tolls, I think the tolls that they're talking about now are way too high, but little modest tolls might work. Sales tax is what was proposed before. That might work. But, I mean, you have to first recognize that you're going to have to pay for roads. They don't come for free. Now, once you've come to that conclusion, it's a matter of how we're going to pay for it, not whether we're going to get it, whether Santa Claus is going to bring it to us. Then you have a more rational discussion. But when people, the same people that are on soapboxes saying no to the sales tax referendum that was killed, are the same people saying no to tolls, and I assume going to be the same people going to say no to gas tax. And that's why we got the backups we have. We ought to step forward and say we need to pay for it. How many would prefer it to be a gas tax? How many would prefer it to be tolls? How many prefer sales tax? How many a combination? But how are we going to pay for it and have that discussion? And maybe we can come to a conclusion. But people who jump up on a soapbox and say, well, you really don't have to pay for it, are the same kind of Republicans that got us in the ditch when you can have a prescriptive drug benefit without paying for it. You can repeal Obamacare, and they say we're going to get rid of the taxes and the mandate. Well, the mandates are there. Governor Romney has mandates in Massachusetts because you can't deal with pre-existing conditions if you let people wait till they get sick before they buy insurance, because everybody will wait till they get sick before they buy insurance, and the insurance for that average is much higher, and it explodes out of control. That's why you have to have everybody buying insurance. Well, you can't get rid of the good parts. You can't have the good parts without the bad parts. The bad parts weren't there by accident. And so when you deal with the budget, it's the same thing. You have to make your choices. Do you want too many air traffic controllers at the airports? Too many children getting Head Start? Are the Pell Grants too high? Is it too much food inspection? Are there too many FBI agents? I mean, exactly what are you talking about? And then make that list, and then we can make some choice. I will guarantee you, if anybody made a list of cuts that they want to make to fund their tax cuts, if anybody made a list, when anybody took a glance at the list, they would say, no, I'd rather the tax cuts expire rather than do all that cutting. And that's why they talk about reducing the size of government with unspecified cuts and sequester and process. But when you start looking at the list, people are outraged with what they have to do, and then they will soon, when they see the choices that are being made, I believe, let the tax cuts expire will be the first thing out of their mouth.
Congressman Bobby Scott, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I don't know how you did it, but you got it all done in 30 minutes. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Kathy.
And we're back in just a moment. We'll be right back. We're at about 27 minutes before the hour, and this is part, if you're just joining us, these are our candidate conversations in the 3rd Congressional District. Essentially, what we do is we take an hour, we divide it by the number of folks in the race that have made the ballot, we give each candidate an equal share of that hour. If they take it, that's great. If they don't, well, they don't. Nothing we can do about that. We talked in the first half hour with Congressman Bobby Scott, and we're talking now with his opponent, Dean Longo, the challenger in the 3rd Congressional District. And again, Dean Longo, nice to meet you today. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for having me. Very nice to have you. So I wanted to sort of talk about some of the same questions we talked about, because this sequestration issue is huge in the 3rd District, as you know.
It's a killer.
So what? So first of all, how this is always one of those what would you have done if you'd have been there kind of questions, but you know, you've got that moment where you have boy we are not going to raise the debt ceiling unless we get a deal here. How would you have voted on that?
I would have voted against it. It's bad policy, and everybody recognizes it's bad policy. It basically put a sword over the top of our head and said, mm-hmm. You need to do something or we're going to cut your head off. Well, that's great, except if something doesn't happen, which is really what's been coming out of Washington for the longest time, then we get our head cut off.
Right.
And that's the problem. Everybody recognizes that the sequester is bad policy. They recognize the damage it's going to do, not only to our national security, but to our economy.
Mm.
I mean, it's going to hurt a lot of people in the 3rd District, and it's going to devastate our economy.
So if you are elected on November 6th, what do you do in those 6 remaining weeks of the year?
Well, there's really nothing I can do at that point because I'm not in.
But can you advocate? I mean, what would you advocate?
We can advocate, and we've been advocating, mm-hmm. because the first thing is we just need to get rid of the sequester. Everybody seems to be tying the sequester to certain different policies. Well, we got to tie the sequester to the Bush tax cut. So we got to tie to the sequester to a certain amount of deficit reduction. You don't have to tie the sequester to anything. It's a law that Congress passed, and Congress can repeal it just as easily. And what I fail to understand is, if everybody agrees that this is bad, why can't we get rid of it? I mean, has Washington become so dysfunctional that there's a policy that nobody agrees to, but we can't get rid of it?
So let's talk about what sort of triggered this whole deal, and that was raising the debt ceiling, because there's a pretty general agreement. Boy, you know, we're spending more than we're taking in. That's not a good thing. How do we get at this? Mm-hmm. How do we get at this budget reduction and reducing this deficit? And so what are your thoughts around that question? How do we get there?
Well, the argument about raising the debt ceiling was a political argument, and it was meaningless. It didn't help anybody, because really the raising the debt ceiling just said that we're going to pay the bills that we've already committed. So whether we're going to argue over that or not wasn't anything that was going to move the bar forward to get us to debt reduction. What would I do for debt reduction? I think that's what I asked you. Well, first we need to grow the economy. More than anything, we need to grow the economy. We also need to hold our spending. If we can hold our spending and not call a cut in an increase as a cut, mm-hmm. I'm talking about real holding, like everybody else in America has to hold their spending too. Hold our spending at 18% of GDP, about where it is now, and raise our, increase the economy so we've got more revenue coming in. That will help us. That will help us bridge that gap. And it has to be over.
But we would have to have a lot of growth in order to do that, right?
Not over a small period of time. If you do incremental growth over an extended period of time, and this has to be done over an extended period of time, then we can get there. If we get about 2% growth in the economy, mm-hmm. hold our spending the way it is today, then in about 5 to 6 years, we can start bridging that gap and we can start getting to something that's manageable.
So some of the, there have been a number of boards and commissions that have come out and said, look, here are 10 ideas for reducing this thing. Among them, letting the Bush tax cuts expire. Mm-hmm. Among them, negotiating Medicare drug prices. Lots of ideas on the table. What about those tax cuts? Some people have said, look, if you make more than $1 million, we're going to let those expire. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, I struggle with raising anybody's taxes to begin with, because first of all, we need to get our spending under control, because anytime we raise taxes and we give Washington more money, it always gets spent. Because I guarantee you, as you and I sit here today, if we allow the Bush tax cuts to expire and give Washington more money, in 2 years, we'll come back here and everybody will be paying more taxes and our debt will still increase. And that's what I struggle more than anything with increasing taxes. You know, we need to get Washington cutting back on its spending and focusing on the things that Washington needs to really be focused on.
But do you believe that can happen without revenue increase? That's really the great debate. How much of this is revenue increase?
How much of it is cost reduction, expense reduction? It obviously can't happen without revenue increase. But I look at revenue increase as increasing the tax base, not taking more money out of people's pockets. Because honestly, I can't afford to pay another dollar. Nobody that I talk to can afford to pay any more money. I mean, the economy has gotten so bad that everybody is making less money. I mean, personally, I'm making 20% below what I was making. I'm actually making 10% below what my family's budgeted at. And now if you want me to pay more taxes on top of that, I don't know how I'm going to make that happen. And knowing that when I send the money up to Washington, it's just going to go to more spending. I mean, I look at the people who are sitting there saying, well, we need to let these tax cuts expire so we can pay down the debt. And the next thing out of their mouth is, well, we need to spend it on this, this, and this. Well, you can't save it and spend it at the same time.
So tell us about your experience. Why did you want to seek out this office? What are you most proud of? What's been your background that brings you to this moment?
Well, this is something honestly that God laid on my heart. I went unemployed. I had a consulting firm and we did government consulting, and government contracts started drying up and I ran out of contracts. And I thought, well, let me just find my network and I'll just get a job with somebody. You know, I know a lot of people out there and I've always been very successful professionally, and nothing was happening. I mean, I went months. All my short-term savings went away. I was into my long-term savings, and I was lucky enough that I'd been able to build that up so I could survive through that. There's a lot of people out there who were in the very same position that I was in, but they had not been able to save up because the economy had been so low. So they can't survive through this. So nonetheless, so I had gone about 4 months and nothing was happening. And then finally one day I was in church, and praise of God, I'm a Messianic Jew, and I go to a Messianic Jewish congregation up on in Newport News. And God kind of laid this on my heart to actually go out, find out the issues that are impacting the people of this district and help them. Bring them a message that we can fix these problems, we can make people's lives better. And that's really what drove us. So we started doing that. And once we started doing that, we realized that this has to be a service-oriented campaign. It can't be focused on me. It can't be focused on Washington. It can't be focused on Republicans versus Democrats. It really has to be focused on the people of this district and the issues that are impacting them. And what have I found? I've found that nobody's watching out for the people. We got a lot of people who are in Congress right now who are doing nothing but complaining about Republicans or complaining about Democrats, and their focus has totally left people, because there's real people with real issues impacting them. Right now in the 3rd District, unemployment is 65% higher than the rest of the state. I mean, Virginia's doing actually pretty good. You know, unemployment in Virginia, I think the last number I saw was 5.9%. We're in the top 10 in the nation. But we are 65% higher than the rest of the state. And African-American unemployment in this district reaches 25%. That's 1 in 4 African-Americans, which is the major group within this district, are unemployed.
So what do you do about that as a congressman in the 3rd? What do you do that would create jobs?
We need to create jobs. We need to bring jobs and money back into the district, because for 20 years, jobs and money have been flowing out. First thing is we need to look at the federal jobs that are here, because we have had federal jobs leaving this district for years. And they're going to help Florida. They're going down to Florida. They're going to Mississippi. They're going up to Connecticut. They're going out to Ohio. And I don't understand why we can so easily allow federal jobs to leave this area. And we talk about the sequester. I mean, that'll make it 10 times worse, especially when we start with the economics that we are now. I mean, if you thought Detroit was bad after the auto industry collapsed, the sequester is going to make, you know, Hampton Roads will make Detroit look like Beverly Hills if the sequester hits. So what we have to do, you asked a question. Let me actually see the look in your eye going, all right, is he going to answer? First, we got to protect federal jobs to make sure that our major industry is not leaving. The second is we need to give incentives to businesses to start hiring people in high unemployment areas. There's a lot of high unemployment areas, as we just talked about. Well, as businesses are growing, we need to give businesses the incentive to start growing by keeping their taxes low and allowing them to invest in themselves. and give them incentives to start hiring people from high unemployment areas.
Cash incentives for this?
Tax incentives. It would be tax incentives more than anything else. The other thing we could do is start giving banks incentives to be able to release capital so that they can start funneling money to small businesses. So small businesses can start growing. When small businesses start growing, then they can start hiring people within the neighborhood. And a lot of these areas with high unemployment rely on a lot of the small family businesses. Mm-hmm. So we need to be paying attention to them and helping them grow.
Let's talk a bit about Medicare, because as you know, that's a real central point in a lot of the campaigns that are underway around the country right now. What do we do about Medicare? A lot of estimates suggest that if we keep on this track, we're not going to be able, this program will not be able to survive over the longer term. So what do you think we do to make Medicare viable over the longer term?
Well, there's a couple of things. First, not to continue the theme, but first we need to grow the economy and get jobs, because the more that people are employed, the more money that's coming into the government, the more revenue, as we talked about, is going into the government. The more revenue is going in, the more we've got to be able to protect the programs that we've promised people, such mm-hmm. as Medicare. But on the top of that, it empowers people. So the more people are employed, the more they're able to take their own healthcare options, and the less they're going to be reliant on government programs, especially as they get older. So the less people you now have reliant on government programs, and the more money you have available to be able to sustain it. So those two, I think help.
What about the issue of negotiating? You know, a lot of people are talking about the negotiation of Medicare mm-hmm. prescription drugs mm-hmm. as being a key to this.
Yeah, I think the negotiation is good. But the big thing that I really believe we need to be focusing on, not only just with Medicare, but with healthcare in general, is just allowing market forces to come into play. Because I believe that the whole healthcare industry is one of the most overregulated in this country. Mm. And because it's so overregulated, it gets to be very high cost. So if we can decrease some of those regulations, allow market forces to come into play, it'll just naturally start dropping.
So are you suggesting then means testing for Medicare, that kind of thing?
I could see means testing for Medicare without a doubt. I could see allowing insurance companies in general to be sold across state lines, so that you can increase the market forces, decoupling insurance companies with jobs. Because right now, if I go to work, I get my health insurance through my work, mm-hmm. and that's the choice that I have. If I can decouple that, if we can just allow a free market of healthcare, just like you see a free market of auto insurance, that'll start lowering the cost because now you have competition.
Let's talk about transportation for a moment. It's certainly a critical issue in the third. You've got situations where we just had a report out that said that so much of our bridge and road infrastructure is problematic. Mm-hmm. We are in a situation where we are told by planners that our construction budget will be completely depleted at the Commonwealth level by 2017. We're talking about tolls that are the subject of a court case right now because the perception mm-hmm. is they're very, very high, and this is
yep.
an unfair burden to place on people. So I wonder, when it comes to transportation for the Commonwealth, how would you go about creating a better transportation options in the third, especially in view of the fact that at the Commonwealth level, we are not able apparently to come to the table with, may not be able to come yeah. to the table with the money that we need yeah. to access federal transportation dollars?
Well, a couple of things. Number one is this primarily a state issue. You know, the state has to put priorities and make priorities for transportation and be able to figure out how to fund that. That's primarily where I come from this. But what I do believe is that the people who benefit from the transportation are the ones who should be paying for it. And you look at the tunnels right now. Right now, the burden of the tunnels and the tolls that are going on those tunnels are primarily being met by the people who live in Portsmouth and live in Norfolk. And that's going to have a huge impact to the small businesses that continually transit back and forth, because it's going to add to their bottom line, or it's going to add to their costs, and it's going to make it difficult for them to make their bottom line. And the only way they're going to be able to do that is by contracting or by laying people off or cutting their market. But nonetheless, I believe that the people who benefit from that transportation are the ones who should be shouldering the burden, and it's not just Norfolk and
so you
and
don't
Portsmouth.
Sort of believe it in as a public enterprise, that sort of an infrastructure ground level, everybody, you don't think that's something that is a function of government, a core function of government?
No, I do. I mm-hmm. do. And what I see is that the people who benefit from those tunnels are, I believe it's regional because of the commerce that goes through those tunnels. We have the only deep water ports in the entire East Coast. So those ports benefit not just the local area, but it benefits the entire region. And the military, the need for the military to be able to access the bases easily, I believe, has a national security aspect to it. So I believe there is a national level interest in making sure we've got a good throughput mm-hmm. through those tunnels. So I do believe there is a role of the national government or the federal government to help out. There was money available to help these tunnels with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act a couple years ago. None of it went to any of these tunnels. And we knew about it back then, but nobody was paying attention. There was money from the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act that went to help build tunnels. There's one out in California. There's one in New York I can point to. But none of that money came here because we weren't watching. And it wasn't that we didn't know about it at the time. So I do believe there's a need for the state level and the federal level to partner mm-hmm. for specific transportation.
Is there one that comes to mind that you think would be one that would be appropriate for that partnership?
Well, the tunnels, without a doubt. Yeah, the Midtown and Downtown tunnels.
Let's talk about women's issues. The reproductive issues for women mm-hmm. put the Commonwealth in the national spotlight during the last General Assembly session. And so I wonder where reproductive initiatives, specifically birth control and abortion, where is that in your own congressional list of priorities? Where does that fit in your scheme of things?
Well, it fits within, first of all, my belief of religious freedom, and as a strong believer, as I said, a Messianic Jew, you know, I'm led by my faith and what I believe is the right thing to do, and I have to go along with what I believe is right, because if I can't lead by what is right, then everything else is meaningless. You know, if I can't tell people this is the right direction to go, then when we talk about the sequester of the tunnels, then all that's meaningless. So where I come down is first of all, I'm anti-abortion. You know, I am pro-life. I believe that we need to minimize abortions. But the best way to do it is instead of doing this legislation, and if legislation came across my desk, there's no question I would vote for it. But what I hate is I hate us getting into this pro-life versus pro-choice argument, because it does nothing but separate us. And Washington politics has separated us for so long that we're no longer really attacking the real issues. With abortion increases with economic status. Basically, what I'm trying to say is the lower economic status you have, the greater the probability of abortion. That's where most of the abortions are. In the low economic area. So what we have to do is we have to economically empower women, so that they're able to choose life over an abortion. We need to have pro-family oriented focuses so that we can have the support network so women are more empowered to choose life over abortion. You know, I'll give you an analogy that's easy. You know,
I want to be sure I give our phone numbers out because I realize I haven't done that yet. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Go ahead.
You know, we can legislate things all we want, but legislating doesn't necessarily stop the problem. I can legislate, you know, murder is bad and murder will be illegal, but that doesn't stop people from murdering people. What we have to do is look and see what's causing it. You know, if you look at the violence rate in an area like Brambleton, and you compare that to the violence in an area like Ghent, the violence in Ghent is a lot lower, and the major variable in that is economic status. When you have economic means and you've got an ability to support yourself, your choices change. So what we need to do with the abortion issue is we need to get people from that position where they don't see any other solution other than an abortion, and move them to a position where they can see, hey, I can keep this baby, or there are other options other than aborting it.
We're at 9 minutes before the hour, and your sourcing around this business of lower income women, the sourcing that we've noted is something on the order of 57% were low income, so it's not a huge difference in terms of abortion, in terms of who's getting abortions. And I guess the question is, where would that be in your list of priorities? And I appreciate your laying out your positions. It's very helpful to know where people are on that, and that's very important. But where would it fall in your list of priorities? I think one of the issues that happened in the General Assembly session last time around was that there was a surprise about the degree to which that was the priority in the session, particularly when a lot of voters were saying, wait a minute, you know, we have, as you know, job issues in the Commonwealth, we have transportation issues, all kinds of other issues out there. Yet this seemed to be the one, certainly in the national perspective, is the one that got the most attention. So where is it in your list of priorities?
Yeah, it wouldn't be at the top of my list. So that wouldn't be a surprise coming out where all of a sudden, hey, you know, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about abortion and women's rights. Because I do believe, like I said, a lot of the things that we have at the top of our list, such as jobs, will help start resolving some of the abortion issues. If we can specifically and economically empower women and economically empower families, then that becomes a good secondary effect that comes along with that. So it's high. It would be high, but it's not at the top of the list.
Are there issues or areas upon which the federal government is spending money right now that you are just completely opposed to? I mean, is there anything that you would say, boy, I really don't want to be spending on that anymore? I'd prefer to be spending on that.
Well, there's a lot of places that the government is spending money that I don't believe the federal government should, because I believe as most things should be done at the state and local level. Federal jobs programs, for example. Federal jobs program spends an awful lot of money, but it doesn't have a huge impact, because the job situation in Miami is different than the job situation in Norfolk, which is different than the job situation in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So we end up with a big program that costs a lot of money, and it solves the job situation in very narrow ranges of localities that just happen to fit into the middle where the policy was designed. I would much rather see state and local level control over programs such as this. Education, I believe, needs to be pushed down to the state and local level and less with the federal government, so that parents have the ability to have more shape over their kids' education.
Jay's on the line from South Norfolk. Hi, Jay. You're on the air. Go right ahead. Turn your radio down.
Thank you for taking my call. I have heard a lot about jobs being the number one issue with this election, jobs and the economy. I've heard a lot of politicians say, I'm in favor of creating good-paying jobs.
Okay.
Yet, to me, this is the test of how grounded they are in reality.
Okay, and what's your question, Jay?
Be specific.
All right,
Jay. Be specific. What does a good-paying job start out paying?
Okay.
I want a dollar amount.
Great.
And I'll listen up
there. All right, Jay. Thank you for the... So Jay wants to be very specific. What do you consider to be a good job, dollar-wise?
Well, I'm not going to be able to answer Jay's question, and if that throws me in with the majority of politicians, I guess that's where I go, because really what it means is I believe any paying job is a good-paying job if you're unemployed. And right now, we have unemployment in this district that's 65% higher than the rest of the state, and African-American unemployment that's 25%. We have felons. We have ex-felons who are out there who are unable to get a job, period, no matter how hard they try, no matter what education or training we give them, because employers aren't hiring them. So at that point, I would tell you any job is a good job. Now, obviously, we need to have people to be economically empowered so they can actually pay their bills. They can live in an environment that's not that doesn't have high violence around them, that they're able to take care of their families, that they're able to take care of their children.
All right, Jay, thank you for the call. Dean Long, I want to thank you very much for joining us in the studio today. It's nice to meet you.
Oh, thank you.
Just to wrap up our conversation, in the first half hour, you heard from Congressman Bobby Scott. He is the Democrat, the incumbent, and Dean Longo is the Republican challenger in the 3rd District and Election Day, November 6th. Again, if you're wondering, and this is an important point for those of you living in the 3rd, in fact, it's an important point for everybody, you really do want to check the State Board of Elections website to find out where you live. Just plug in your address. It'll tell you what district you live in now, because fully 15% of the 3rd congressional district is made up today of folks who in the last election were in the 1st, the 2nd, the 4th, and the 7th. So it really is important for you to check that out. We do have that link for you as well on our Facebook page. Don't forget the debate tonight on foreign policy, the presidential debate coming to you from Lynn University in Boca Raton, Florida. That will be moderated by Bob Schieffer, who's the host of Face the Nation. session on CBS. It gets underway at 9 o'clock p.m. till 10:30. And again, the subject is foreign policy. It will be on WHRO TV 15 tonight, as well as simulcast on 89.5 WHRV. That's the station you're listening to right now. The format will be identical to the first presidential debate. And again, the subject will be on foreign policy. So that is coming up tonight from 9 to 10:30 on WHRO TV 15. Thanks so very much for joining us today. Lots of things going on in the community that we want to make sure that you are aware of. You can find many of them on our Facebook page. And on Wednesday, we'll have a recap and an analysis on Wednesday with Charles Dunn from Regent University. And so we hope you will join us for that as well. And again, if you're interested in more information about the debates and about the elections, you can always log on to our Facebook page or onto our website. We have our programs back there 6 years. It's a pretty incredible thing. And so we hope you'll do that. You can also download this broadcast on iTunes, and that will let us go with you wherever you go, which we always like to do. We're a really, really cheap date. So I hope you'll be sure to download the podcast, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow. Thanks for listening.